Right, look, it's great to see you all here tonight. And it's been a very long day for Ali Abunima, who's here on his third talk. So the introductions will be brief, but I've got a few pieces of information that I'd like to give you before we get started. First of all, for people who don't know me, my name's Heather Goodall. I'm a professor of history here in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. And in that faculty, a great many of us are extremely interested in electronic journalism, and we're interested in interventions in public debates. Tony Maniarty, the director of the UTS Centre, the Australian Centre for Independent Journalism, is unable to be here tonight. He had been hoping to introduce Ali. So he's asked me to introduce him on behalf of the centre and on behalf of my own research centres, the Centre for Transforming Cultures, and indeed on behalf of the university itself and the student body. Ali's visit to Australia is supported by the Sydney-based Coalition for Justice and Peace in Palestine, and his trip has been supported by a great many of the organisations around Australia who have been working tirelessly for open debate and for information flow about what's happening in Palestine. Now, the three things that I want to mention to you before we start are firstly the number of very important events which are occurring over the next few days. Tonight, at a very late period of time, at 11:45, the documentary I Remember 1948 is being shown on SBS television, and we'd strongly urge you to watch that or record it and keep it. This is an important half-hour film, that's all it is, but it gives you eyewitness accounts from Palestinian refugees who lost their homes and their homeland in 1948. Secondly, I've already told you that the ABC is filming tonight. The way we'll organise it is that Ali will speak to introduce his ideas in the book that he's written, which is on sale outside, as well as in the overall work of electronic journalism that he's been doing, the Electronic Intifada, which I'll speak about in a moment. He'll introduce that for about half an hour, and then we'll throw the meeting open for discussion and questions. And we'd ask everybody to keep their questions to the point, and we're looking for an open and a free discussion about the issues that Ali's going to raise. Finally, Jan's also told you about becoming a member of the Australian Centre for Independent Journalism, and if you find Jan at the end, after you've bought Ali's book, you can organise to get yourself signed up. Now, I'd just like to say in a very brief introduction that, as we've said before, tonight's talk is called Electronic Journalism on the Path to Peace in Palestine. And we're here because over this period of time this week is a commemoration of the catastrophic partition of Palestine in 1947-48, remembered as al-Nakba, the process which began the dispossession and the dispersal of Palestinian people, in which hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were forced from their homes. But we're also celebrating, in a way which will be very recognisable to Australians and Indigenous Australians, the survival of Palestinian people and their survival of their hope and their optimism and their plans for a just peace in their homeland. Ali Abunima's family has direct experience of that expulsion and dispossession, and Ali himself has for a long time been a distinguished analyst of events in the Middle East and in Palestine, and he'll be speaking about those tonight. But as well, and what has been critically important for Australians, has been his role as a co-founder of the site Electronic Intifada, which is, for me, an absolutely unique and incredibly important trailblazer in electronic journalism, which offers the whole range of from rigorous analysis of events in Palestine and the Middle East. It offers reflective opinion pieces from a range of people. It offers first-hand eyewitness accounts. It offers visual material. It offers reflective graphic material. It has the whole range of things that we're looking for very often in issues, but which we can't find. And it does it instantaneously, virtually. We can have access to this material anytime. Wherever in the world we've got broadband and bandwidth, which is not everywhere, but at least it's somewhere. And in the emergencies like the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 2006, this site was able to mobilise and organise the Electronic Lebanon site, which gave us that same high-quality, credible journalism about the emergency as it unfolded. So with that, I'd like to hand over to Ali and ask to hear some of the important things he's got to say, and then find your questions to ask him about the work he's been doing. Thank you, Ali.
Thank you very much, Professor Goodall. Thank you very much for that very generous introduction, and I'd like to thank all those who have worked to make this event possible and to make my visit to Australia possible. It's been exhilarating so far. I arrived on Friday. I feel like I've been here a month, and I'm leaving in about another 12 days, so that's about 6 months from now, according to the kind of pace we've been keeping. But it's absolutely wonderful to have this opportunity to talk to people and to learn firsthand how these discussions and how Palestine, Israel is viewed from Australia. I'm often described as a journalist, and I know that many of you here are studying for careers and preparing for careers in journalists in journalism, or are working as journalists. A lot of the time what I do is similar to what journalists do, but I've never actually thought of myself as a journalist, and I never had the ambition to be a journalist. I actually started off as a crank. Is that a term you use in Australia? Way back in the 1990s, I would wake up every morning and listen to the news on what we call National Public Radio in the United States, which is our national radio network, a little bit similar to ABC or the BBC or the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Not exactly, because there isn't really a tradition of government support for public interest broadcasting. But nevertheless, that's the equivalent. And it used to drive me absolutely mad, because the reporting from Palestine, I felt, was very one-sided, very inaccurate. And I took upon myself the sole burden of correcting NPR's coverage. And I did that by writing letters to them every day, sometimes several times a day. And a small selection of them are still on the internet floating around. And this is a very small selection of the letters I wrote to NPR. And so let's see. There was, it's the sorts of complaints that, typically I would wake up early in the morning, listen to the news bulletins, and then, make my notes and write to NPR, and it's hard to believe that this is 10 years ago, detailing all my complaints. And some of the letters are better than others. And some of them actually elicited, corrections from NPR. So, I was always very proud when I got NPR to acknowledge that I was right about something, which wasn't very often, even though I was right 98 or 99% of the time, of course. But then what I started doing was, I'd share these letters with friends, how you forward emails to people, and that list of people grew and grew. Then I became known as the person who writes letters to NPR. So it really started off as a reaction to what I felt was really consistently and persistently one-sided and shoddy reporting. And the things I would complain about typically, and I think are still very present in a lot of the media coverage, was a lack of context. The fact that events that were occurring in the West Bank or Gaza Strip were happening in the context of Israeli military occupation was almost never mentioned, for example. There was often, I think this one, violence when it affected Palestinians was almost never reported, or often reported in a very impersonal way, with very few details about who the victim of the violence was, who the perpetrator, if it was a civilian or not. Whereas when Israelis were the victims of violence, there'd be often be very moving, very personal, very detailed reports telling us information about the victim, often their name, their age, what they were doing, and so on and so forth. There was this is a pattern that that I'll say more about in a moment. I don't want to give you the impression that I was the only person in the world doing this sort of thing, but it was a time back in the 1990s when I think myself and other people were discovering the power of the internet for the first time to allow us to talk back to the media. This is a cliche. Well, the cliche isn't the right word, but you know, or maybe it is. You know, the idea that now everything is interactive, and you go to any newspaper website, and you know, there's a string of comments underneath from readers, and usually most of them are not really very interesting or insightful. It's just a way for the newspapers to get eyeballs on the page so that advertisers will pay more, and so on. But at the time, you know, the idea that we still were in a situation where the media, whether it was newspapers or television or radio, spoke to you, and you sat there and absorbed it in silence. And what we were able to do for the first time was to answer back. And I have to say, I take credit for driving NPR crazy single-handedly. And if you go back and look in the newspaper archives, they actually sort of, you know, say that there's this one person who won't stop writing to us. I'm not claiming it made much difference. I'm just claiming that I drove them a bit crazy. But the other thing we started to do was more and more people would sort of get involved and say, you know, let's do this more systematically. So that was one thing. The other thing, I think, that was going on for the first time, I think somewhere in, you know, on Wikipedia, I haven't looked, but if you look up the Wikipedia article on blogs, I think they date the first blog to about 1998 or 1999, and I can't remember exactly who it was. But I think this is one of the first blogs in the world. And it actually comes out of Palestine. It was created by Nigel Parry, who was living in Palestine at the time, and in the mid-1990s began keeping a daily diary from Palestine. And you can, it's still online, and you can go back. It starts... actually, I think it is the first blog in the world, and Wikipedia dates the first blog to about 1997 or 1998. Of course, the word blog hadn't been invented then. Nigel Parry called it a diary. But this was his personal first-hand account of life in Palestine, and if you pick any particular diary entry, they were often accompanied by pictures that he took. So what Nigel Parry was doing for the first time was actually, and at the time I don't think I even recognized sort of the importance and possibility of what he was doing, but doing first-hand reporting without being the correspondent of a major network, without being sent by a big newspaper, just doing the reporting himself. So I was reacting to the media using the internet, not me only, I'm just giving it to you from my perspective. And Nigel was among the first who were actually saying, let's create something different. And eventually, Nigel, myself, and a couple of other colleagues, Ariane El-Fasid and Laurie King, and over the years, we've had many, 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 many people helping us, brought these ideas or experiments together into the Electronic Intifada, and that's really the genesis of it. It was something that we were each doing from our own little corner, and then came up with the idea. Of course, the Electronic Intifada didn't look the way it does now. It's also rather old-fashioned now, I would say. We're in the midst of doing a major redesign, which hopefully, if they stop having wars in Lebanon, we will be able to focus on for a few solid months. We hope that we will be able to focus on it, and that that circumstances and events will allow us to do that. So what started off, I think, as a reaction has become, we hope, a viable, independent media service. We think of ourselves, it drives me crazy now when people refer to the Electronic Intifada as a blog. It's not that I have anything against blogs, but again, we predate that phenomenon, although I think Nigel pioneered it. But I think what we try to do is more than just blogging. We're living in a moment, I think, in which there is an enormous transition. If you talk to people who, and there are many distinguished media professionals here amongst us tonight, but if you talk to people in the news media, I think there's a consensus that we're in a moment of tremendous transition. In the sense that the traditional models of big media, newspapers, major networks are being challenged. I don't know what the situation is in Australia, but newspaper circulation in the United States is literally collapsing. That there are declines of something like 5 to 10% a year, revenues are collapsing, and what's happening is that reporters are being laid off. And the impact of that for society at large is serious. You see, I have a long history of complaining about the media, but so I don't romanticize or idealize reporters. Nevertheless, we have relied on there being major media organizations to go out and do the footwork of reporting day to day. And in the brave new world we live in, there's all this excitement about bloggers. But if we live in a world where there are 50 million op-ed columnists and no reporters, then I think we're going to have a seriously warped sense of what reality is. And this is something that will have an impact in reporting on communities and neighborhoods in Sydney or Chicago, but will be even more acute when it comes to reporting on places like Palestine, where there is almost no, right now, very few foreign correspondents. Those who are there are mostly comfortably settled in Israeli West Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv and rarely venture into Palestinian areas, and that leaves an enormous gap. And it also creates an opportunity for people like us to try to fill it. And we try very hard to be taken seriously in what we do. I just want to point out a few of the sort of highlights that I think really illustrate some of the more structural problems that we hit upon and some of my favorite little pieces. One of the, I think, impacts, I already talked about that in the context of the letters to NPR, of the fact that reporters are not really there among Palestinians, are not really aware of or don't think the context is important, is that they miss a lot. And one example of that, and this I think you can still find examples of, but back in, this dates from 2003, there was a period of from October 4th until mid-December, till December 25th, Christmas Day, when the media, many organizations, including the Los Angeles Times, you see here a whole smattering, the Montreal Gazette, Chicago Tribune, CNN, were reporting that there had been a period of relative calm. And a typical headline was that on December 25th, there was a bombing which killed several Israelis. And across the English language news media, they reported 12-week lull in Mideast ends, Mideast quiet shattered, suicide bombing kills four Israelis shortly after assassination in Gaza, the Chicago Tribune, coming less than an hour apart, the 25th December attacks broke a lull that had lasted more than 2 months and raised fears of a slide into violence. This struck us because when we actually, what we had been reporting on the electronic intifada during that 12-week period was anything but a lull. In fact, we counted that during this 12-week period, 117 Palestinians had been killed, 23 of them children. And in the same period, Israel had destroyed almost 500 Palestinian homes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And that period was reported as a period of relative quiet or a lull, which ended when four Israelis were killed. And that is actually pretty typical, not exceptional. I think another challenge we face has been that in the absence of any context, there has been a tendency to reduce the question of Palestine or the conflict to one of personality. And this was particularly true during the lifetime. The ABC is going to absolutely hate me because I keep doing this. So see if I can tuck this in my pocket. There has been a tendency, this was very much true during, while Yasser Arafat was alive, to reduce Palestinian behavior to the character of Yasser Arafat, that everything was down to Arafat the Almighty. And we're not beyond having a sense of humor, so we actually used to make fun of that too. So we had a funny section on the electronic intifada where, but it sort of satirized patterns that we had seen repeated throughout the media. So this, I suppose, is a satire of a typical US media report where the ability of Palestinians was constantly exaggerated, and the acts and deeds of the Israelis was constantly minimized. And I think we have, yeah, there you go. So for those who, I don't know if the screen is visible to everyone, but I'll just read the lead paragraph. Tel Aviv, BNN is a Basale news network. Basale is an onion, and probably infringing copyright here because I don't know if you know The Onion, the US satirical paper, but anyway, don't, ABC, please, don't report that. So defense ministry sources in Israel revealed today that Israel's army is struggling to meet the threats from a Palestinian super rock, which it is feared will decimate Israel's tank forces in the occupied territories. So, and there's the graphic. Says before rocks were just part of the landscape, and of course the report goes into all the secret bunkers that Palestinians had where they were developing these rocks. So, but you know, it was sort of a comment on the constant exaggeration of Palestinian abilities and the constant minimization of what Israel was doing and the lack of context. And then I think, finally, something that we, and there's a lot more I could say, but I'm just limiting myself. I think that one of the most worrying features of how the reporting of this conflict has done, that started before September 11th for sure, but has particularly intensified since then, is to place Palestinians within the context of this so-called global war on terror, where Israel is an extension of what is misleadingly called Western civilization, and the Palestinians are just a mad bunch of jihadis who have no rational motives. They're not reacting to anything real. And when there's a lack of context, when you don't tell people that Palestinians are living under a military occupation, then it's very understandable that people would say, well, why are they so violent? Why? What's their problem? Why can't they just chill out? And that is heightened in this sort of global atmosphere of constructing or reconstructing all of these various local conflicts into a sort of global jihad against the West that I think the media are deeply implicated in. One of the things I think that what we've tried to do more and more, the Electronic Intifada started off very much reacting to news media and sort of setting the record straight. And I think one of the things we've moved towards more recently is actually trying to do a lot more original reporting. I hope this will work. So, for example, we now have a permanent correspondent in Gaza who files reports for us once or twice a week, and in this sense is doing something fairly, and this, I haven't read this, but this is from today, where we actually report the way that traditional media might have done on life in Gaza, and we have various correspondents around Palestine and in Lebanon. This is done on a shoestring, of course, and often we're relying on the goodwill of people who are contributing their work. But we have moved, in a sense, into a more traditional role, we think, in some ways. We've also had our share of scoops. I got my revenge on NPR in 2002 when we exposed that their reporter, Linda Gradstein, who reports from Jerusalem, has been for years, was actually violating NPR's stated policy and basic journalistic ethics by accepting routinely thousands of dollars from pro-Israel groups for speaking engagements while reporting on Israel-Palestine. She's still working for them. It's quite remarkable. There was a case a few years before this when a reporter was fired from National Public Radio because her husband had once worked as a consultant for the Palestinian Authority, and she hadn't disclosed that. There wasn't, I think, any allegation that she'd done anything wrong, but Linda Gradstein had actually, and we go through it, it's all the detail, and we know what the libel laws are, so we were very careful to investigate and check our facts and so on. More recently, we had great fun with this report on Wikipedia, which, just waiting for this a bit slow, here we go, where we had another little scoop. So we, again, using what we think are traditional investigative methods,
Of course, I cannot reveal our sources and methods. We cannot jeopardize ongoing operations. But CAMERA is a pro-Israel pressure group. That CAMERA stands for Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. And this is a group that makes it its business to bombard with emails and calls and letters and press releases any journalist or news media that is not doesn't take a Likudnik approach to reporting on Palestine or Israel. And we had a lot of fun because we uncovered a secret plan by CAMERA staff to infiltrate Wikipedia, the increasingly popular online encyclopedia, to basically rewrite the pages on Palestine. And this was quite significant because a lot of journalists now rely on Wikipedia. You know, they just, you need to check something, you go onto Wikipedia. And this was a group, and I suspect there's probably more of this than we know about for all sorts of different issues. Here was a group undertaking an organized effort to infiltrate Wikipedia, to find the weaknesses in its structure and exploit them to promote a specific agenda. And the fun part about it is we got all the emails from Wikipedia. You can see if this will work. We got all their emails and published them. They're absolutely infuriated, of course. This story was picked up so far since I've been traveling, I haven't followed it up on it. So the whole file of all the emails is there. But this story was picked up and reported in the Boston Globe, the Jerusalem Post, the American Prospect, and there's several others. And that's an example where little old us managed to break a story that was seen as having greater significance. So there we are. Statistics. I'll end with that because people always ask me. See how I use a Mac at home, so I find the PC a little clunky. But this is our current traffic, so it's all very transparent. We're currently getting between 2,500 and 5,000 unique visitors a day. We think we can do much better than that, but that's pretty good, and that's about 68,752 individuals in the past 30 days. But when you think back 5 or 10 years ago, the possibility of reaching that many people around the world, if you didn't own a newspaper or a magazine or a radio station, it was just impossible. I think that it's been pretty remarkable for us to be able to have that kind of reach. And the quality of the audience in terms of it being a very, very engaged, very active audience, and there's a multiplier effect because all of the material we publish is circulated more widely. So I think I'll stop there. I didn't say much about the book because I've been talking about it all day and wanted to focus on the media. I should take the take advantage, being media savvy, take advantage of ABC being here to talk about it, but I'll wait until someone asks me a question, and I'd like to open the discussion now to all of you. So thank you very much.